The following program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Support for the distribution of this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the H.J. Heinz Company Foundation. The Nature of Music series is produced by Garuda Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Garuda Productions, The Nature of Music.
Why do a lot of people turn on the local classical station on their FM radios and keep it on all day? Because it's a kind of reassuring muzak. They don't hear. They wouldn't know the difference between Mozart and Brahms. But that's okay. I'm not arguing with that. I can't do it because I start listening and stop washing the dishes or whatever that I'm supposed to be doing.
I'm Lynn Farmer. This time on The Nature of Music, we're talking about music and the listener. How do listeners really use music? Are there different ways of listening to music? In this half hour, historian Jacques Barzan says that you're missing the point if you think that you must listen to music for its technical details. Anthropologist Marina Roseman finds that teenagers use music to make contact with something larger than themselves. And interviews with the man on the street in Japan reveal some remarkable similarities and differences between their listening and ours. But first, jazz critic Martin Williams talks about how he chooses the music he listens to.
I know that even for me, there are certain musicians that I can put on while I'm doing something else, and others I can't. And that applies to any kind of music. I mean, I can put on Miles Davis, I can put on the Modern Jazz Quartet, and I can put on Art Tatum and do something else and think about something else. But I couldn't put on Thelonious Monk and do anything else. He won't let you. He says, you either listen to this or turn it off, you know.
Yes, but why does Martin Williams put on music while he's washing the dishes? Why do we seem to reach for music whenever we can? Canadian composer R. Murray Schafer.
What is it about our own acoustic environment that makes it necessary for us to be in the presence of music as many hours as possible through the day? Is the acoustic environment so decadent that we're trying to smother it? We're trying to isolated in some way. Certainly the Walkman seems to indicate that. Probably also as a result of the acoustic environment too, inasmuch as the acoustic environment is so heavy, so saturated with sounds, that it has perhaps tended to develop an appetite for noise among us, so that we need to have a certain amount of acoustic commotion around us, otherwise we tend to feel frightened. And so we're frightened of silence.
Oh, imagine the world without music. Be terrible. Just terrible. In fact, I think they've gone even too far, because now you can't even go to the bathroom without the music playing. You should have some of the silence in between to be able to appreciate the music.
Mitch Miller, who would probably agree with poet Robert Kelly that there's a difference between hearing and listening. Kelly thinks there's a good reason why we constantly need environmental music.
We have in English these two words, hearing and listening, and they're interesting that they're so different, because you can hear music without listening to it, you can listen to it without hearing it, Nowadays, it's hard to be in any public place without music being present in Muzak form or radio, or the painter painting the side of your house is listening to the radio, and the plumber in the basement is listening to the radio, always in the presence of music. And this constitutes then music as environmental protection. It's something like people in polluted environments wearing masks over their snouts to to protect their breathing systems. I don't know. It's a way of hiding. I'm not sure what it is, but I know it's different from the way in which you would listen to music if you were really listening. You would not walk into a concert hall and listen to a pianist that way. You would not walk into a club and listen to Dizzy Gillespie that way. And it seems to me then we're talking about different orders of listening.
Dizzy Gillespie, of course. Music you can't just hear, you have to listen to it. This is The Nature of Music, and we're talking about the listener. Most of what comes up in this series applies to just about all music, we think. In order to find out how listeners in another country might use music, we asked the Japanese Broadcasting Corporation to conduct some man-in-the-street interviews with ordinary listeners in Tokyo. Here's what they said.
My day starts with the music. When I'm dressing, I listen to the music. So you listen to the music all day? Yes. And you listen to every kind of music? Yes, and when I want to listen to a quiet music, I listen to the quiet music. So use the music to change your mood. And if I'm stuck on the desert island, I will take my cassette tapes. Do you listen to your Walkman all the time? Yes, day and night. What kind of music do you listen to? Well, it doesn't matter. I listen to all kinds of music. How does the music affect on you? If I don't have Walkman, I listen to all the noisy sounds of cars and traffic. But if I can listen to the music that I like, I don't get nervous. And at night at home, when I'm reading, if it gets too quiet, I miss the sound. Then I turn on the music. When did you first become interested in rock music? Since I was junior high school student. Why did you like rock music at that time? Because they were good looking and their appearance was good and they were popular too. And do you still like rock music? Yes. Because they express the things that we want to express also. And the sounds and lyrics are the things that we exactly want to express. And do your friends like rock music too? Yes. And the friends who like rock music tend to get together and talk about rock music.
Did you ever hear a certain song and suddenly this picture flashes in your mind of that one boyfriend or girlfriend you met at school? Hugo Kiesing is a psychologist who specializes in the history of popular music.
Music, when I hear it, fixes a time, a place, a situation. Music becomes a series of reference points, simply for my life. If I hear a song that was popular in 1959, I can probably tell you at about what time of the year it was popular, who I was with, what I was doing, what courses I was taking. Now, that's a very personal relationship, and it's not the same. Like, for others, it is, it's a social commodity. That is, I think young people relate to one another, form groups based on likes in music. There are many tongue-tied 14- and 15-year-old adolescents who will use records to kind of break the ice. You put the appropriate record on when you're with that person that you want to get closer to, and you let the record tell the story.
Then there's a whole interesting set of connections that happens where relationships with friends, relationships with people, certain times in people's lives become associated with particular songs. And then when they want to remember that person or bring back that time, that's the record they'll play.
Anthropologist Marina Roseman. She used the students at Cornell University to find out how young people use music.
There again, when relationships break up, those songs can either become too loaded and a whole set of records will be relegated to non-play for 2 years until they're less painful, or some people will choose to relive their relationship almost nostalgically, cry to the songs that were once our song. Similarly with periods in people's lives, people going through transitions from one place to another will take the music that reminds them of the place before or the summer before school started, and when exams get too hard, start playing the music that was popular during the summer, for example, to bring back riding in the convertible by the beach with that particular song playing.
Summer's not the same this year, the reason why is very clear. You're not here.
People find a way of identifying their personal crises with something much larger than themselves via the various songs that become popular. One song that emerged several times was Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying the stairway to heaven. She gets there, she knows, if the stores are all closed, with a word she can get what she came.
It starts slow, and yet it also has a build in orchestration and a triumphant sort of ending, so that they can start out with it feeling depressed and move through their depression and transformed to feeling fine when they're listening to Stairway to Heaven, for example.
And she's buying a stairway to heaven.
Ethnomusicologist Charles Kyle and his students interviewed about 50 people in the Buffalo, New York area. They asked two related questions: who are you, and what is music about for you? Kyle found that each person had individual tastes, and that what they listened to didn't conform at all to the stereotypes of the rock fan, or the easy listening fan, or the blues fan. Their very first interview was with a woman who built her whole world around the Allman Brothers and Bette Midler.
Ain't these tears in these eyes telling you?
That is, she had 20s and 30s music because Bette Midler did that kind of music. And her Allman Brothers collection, which was also complete and definitive, led her into different kinds of blues, into certain kinds of folk music, and so on and so forth. But Bette Midler, to catharse negative feelings, and the Allman Brothers for party time, and all other music organized around those two poles, seemed to me a very specific and strange sort of world, until I went and looked at another 50 interviews, and 49 people have similar kinds of polarizations in their musical preferences and specific patterns that don't match up in any way that I could find with the Billboard charts. It's not as if there are country and western people out there and soul music people and people who fill this imaginary subculture. People are listening to a variety of things and picking and choosing what they want for their own unique, highly unique purposes.
Composer Libby Larson also went out and asked listeners about how they used music and how they felt about it. After playing a piece for them, she'd say, "Tell me about the music."
And always it will start with, "I liked it," "I didn't like it." And then to try and get them to articulate, especially the person who didn't like it is the one that I'll zero in on. And they will say, "It was boring." And I'll say, "Well, how did you feel?" "Well, I felt restless, I felt frustrated, I felt tense." And I'll ask, "Why?" And then they'll say, "Well, the chords made me feel tense." No. And now they're beginning to talk about dissonance. They don't know the technical word for it. That doesn't matter. They begin to talk about the music. And by the time we've gotten through what made them say boring, you know, which is a typical adolescent term, you know, for anything that disturbs you one way or another, we found out that indeed they weren't bored by the piece of music. They were totally engaged in it, just unable to connect on more than an entertainment level.
Not bored, but just unable to connect. Your ability to connect with music changes, in the opinion of anthropologist Tony Seeger. He says the way you connect depends on who, when, and how.
People hear things quite differently. They hear things according to their own experience to a great extent, and their own experience grows as they get older, and it is different in many societies whether they're men or women. And so the same sound, the same song, can be interpreted quite differently by a child hearing it for the first time, a person who is an adult and has heard only another form of music and hears a new form for the first time, or someone who's heard many performances of the same piece, let's say, and is comparing it, what he's hearing, simultaneously with many of the past experiences. So yes, there's definitely an individuality to the hearing of a piece, of any kind of music, just as there is an individuality to the way that particular people may produce it.
And I, for one, believe that listening to music, technically, as it were, for its devices and internal overcoming of difficulties, is not good listening. Though many people would suppose that if they could do that, they would get more out of the music. That's nonsense. It's like saying that you read a poem, and if you could parse the sentences and see how the clauses fit together and whether the plural verb goes with a plural or a singular subject, you wouldn't be getting the poem at all.
Jacques Barzin is a historian.
The professional musician brings to the listening to a new piece all sorts of concerns of his own. He wants to know what new tricks this fellow is up to and whether he pulls them off adequately or not. The music theorist, particularly if he is a sort of dry-as-dust person, is looking for form and modulation. How does he get from the first theme to the second? Is his transition really good? Is it awkward, clumsy, brusque, and so on? And the total, not ignoramus, but let me use the word innocent again, sits there and, as Santayana put it, may be undergoing a drowsy reverie interrupted by nervous thrills.
Thank you.
Charlie Parker was a very orderly improviser. I think if we are not aware of the order and the genuine logic of his improvised melodies, consciously, we sense it. It's the same in any music. I mean, how many people really know all those inner workings of variation and structure that go on in a Beethoven symphony? Very few listeners, but they like it and they're responding to it anyway. And the same kind of thing happens, I think, with a good jazz solo. If the listener senses that this is an entity, that this adds up to something, but he doesn't really articulate how the development of one, two, or three motives throughout 32 bars or 64, how many it is, really makes that happen.
I'm Lynn Varmer, and we're talking about the listener this time on The Nature of Music. Later in this half hour, Trevor Pinnock, the English conductor, says a concert is like a trip into the unknown. It's a mystery. But first, pianist Emmanuel Ax has observed audiences around the world from the performer's point of view.
It depends so much on the background of the audience. There are various customs in various places. For example, the most respectful audience I know is probably in England, especially outside of London. The stillness is something so unbelievable. But you feel that, over there at any rate, I feel the reason they're so quiet is because they have tremendous respect and dignity. They have great respect for the performer and the music. With the German audience, you get very often also great silence. But that, I think, is more because they're actually concentrating on the music. It's different in every place. New York audiences, which I think are absolutely fabulous, are not nearly that quiet. But I think they're wonderful. I think they get very excited. They're very suggestible. No, and they want to hear good concerts. They're very enthusiastic about good concerts.
Trevor Pinnock plays the harpsichord and conducts the English Concert Baroque Ensemble. Pinnock says there's a special bond that's created between the performer and the listener.
If we play our music well, I would expect to have the involvement of the audience. Of course, on all sorts of different levels. There's no need for everybody in an audience or for one audience to be the same as another. There's no need that the appreciation should be on the same level. Some people will tend to have an appreciation which is more on a mental appreciation. Some will be fascinated, especially by the technical makeup of the music. Others will respond purely on a gut level. Just as, you know, there's so many different personalities of people, and people respond according to their own personalities. But I find that if one's playing the music really honestly and well and involving the audience, whatever sort of audience, there should be a sort of electric involvement.
Trevor Pinnock says that every musical encounter is something mysterious and out of the ordinary.
Well, it's exciting, isn't it? It's a journey into the unknown. You're going to a concert, you don't know really what's... You're hoping that something's going to happen to you. It's not just ordinary. It's not just like going to your office to do your work. I would hope that at the best moments that we attain a sort of higher spiritual plane than we normally attain, and that in the best moments of music making, we, as performers and the audience with us, are moving on this plane, which we don't really know very much about, but we just know enough to know that there is something there. I think that I'm not sure that we should know much more about it than that. I think we should just accept it as a fact and leave some of the mystery. I think mystery is a marvellous thing.
Bach Concerto for Harpsichord and Strings in D Major, performed by the English Concert. Trevor Pinnock conducted from the harpsichord. If you'd like a free program guide to the Nature of Music series, or information on how to order a cassette of this program on Music and the Listener, write to The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Here's that address again. The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Thanks to NHK, the Japanese Broadcasting Corporation, for the interviews with listeners in Tokyo. Thanks also to NPR member stations WBFO in Buffalo and WETA in Washington. Our program on Music and the Listener is written and produced for Garuda Productions by Carl Signell and Deborah Jane Lamberton. John Widoff is the mix engineer. The executive producer for the series is Dr. Carl Signell. This series is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. I'm Lynn Farmer. This is NPR, National Public Radio.